The mind must not die until its own work has been completed and its function has reached the highest possible degree of perfection. As the mind increases in power and rationality, it grows gradually to realize that there is something beyond thought. The mind is capable of realizing this power but is never able actually to contact it. There is a supermental state, which is synonymous to a certain extent with the causal sphere. The Buddhist sees consciousness as a universal sea. Consciousness is therefore something that is moved only by a divine ebb and flow, by a realization of itself. This universal, all-penetrating sea is the true substance of everything, for consciousness, or self, was before the beginning and consciousness, or self, is after the end. Beginning and end are illusions, but self is eternal. Consciousness is therefore union with self. Consciousness knows no separateness. As long as me and thee exist, consciousness is not perfected. Life and death, good and evil, light and shadow, these are the illusions of mind. But in consciousness, diversity is totally annihilated and all things are one in reality and in essence. The bond of brotherhood is proved by the mind to be good, but the realization of brotherhood is not consciousness. The bond of friendship is demonstrated by the intellect to be necessary, but friendship is less than consciousness. There is no consciousness until the slash in each is one and indivisible from the slash in all. Until we arc everything that we in our ignorance believe surrounds us, there is no complete consciousness. We may study the star intellectually, but we have never attained consciousness until we arc the star, the stone, the heavens, and the earth. When our consciousness is perfect, we extend from the heights of height to the depths of depth. We permeate the whole nature of existence, we are in everything, we are through everything, we arc the whole nature of everything. The difference between intellect and consciousness is there. For the difference between a mental concept of an object and an actual mingling of our consciousness with the consciousness of the object itself. This latter state is realization. The intellectual concept, however, must to a certain degree precede the consciousness. As the mind is higher than the body, and the body must ultimately accept the thinking organism as its master, so consciousness is higher than mind, and the mind must ultimately give way to it. The mind is a bridge connecting consciousness and unconsciousness, but having crossed the bridge, it is left behind, its usefulness past. As a bridge, however, the mind is a vital necessity, and he who depreciates it is as false as he who permits himself to become the servant of its whims. The Buddhist priest entering into nirvana, and the Brahmin bridging the chasm between mortal consciousness and samadhi, both cast aside mind as a snare and a delusion, yet without it, the very principles upon which they work would be incomprehensible to them. The Eastern mind, endeavoring to annihilate the unreal and mingle itself with the real, depends first upon the intellect to reveal the processes of illumination and the reasonableness of their abstract conceptions. The Western schools of philosophy differ from the Eastern in that they teach the perfection of the mind before its rejection, whereas the Eastern schools are prone to regard the mind as a hindrance to be discarded at the very beginning of spiritual growth. Thus, the Eastern mystic with his own nature slays the mind, while the Western philosopher, by elevating the mind to a realization of its own insufficiency, causes the intellect voluntarily to offer itself as a willing sacrifice upon the altar of spirit. The ability to feel with rather than for is the essential difference between consciousness and emotion. When we feel for things, we are emotionally moved. Pity, sympathy, and kindred Illumined Mind, The Universal Savior 65. 66 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Feelings stir us, and yet they seldom give any definite impulse. That is of value in the adjustment of any chain of circumstances. When we feel with things, we are so much a part of them that we understand the innermost elements of their being. Thus, understanding comes with consciousness, and knowledge with intellectual comprehension. According to the ancient doctrines, perfect consciousness, the ability to feel with everything as part of everything, was regarded as the ultimate state of so-called human unfoldment, and he who had achieved this had attained to godhood in his own right. The gods are simply emblematic of varying degrees of consciousness in that vast interval between ignorance and realization. At present, humanity is semi-conscious, conscious over the area of the known, and unconscious over the area of the unknown. We have reached a degree of consciousness that enables us to study the exoteric, or outer, constitution of things. We will never know the urges, however, that cause the diversified phenomena of existence up till we are united with the inner nature that animates the outer body. Consciousness is gauged, therefore, by our ability to unite our selves with the soul urges of those creatures that surround us. And true greatness is measured by the power to come en rapport with the causes of objective manifestation. Many centuries ago, there was founded in Korea a group of Eastern thinkers of Buddhist persuasion who developed the science of realization to a higher degree than any group since Gautama himself. The story is told that to one of the monasteries of this order in Japan, there came a disciple who dedicated his life to the attainment of this inner consciousness. Year after year, he struggled to master the illusions of his outer nature and find the infinite and all-pervading self within. His patience was tireless, his devotion unwavering. Yet the passing years found no apparent improvement in his spiritual condition. He was never able to be one with all the life that surrounded him. After having spent the best part of a lifetime in wandering and meditation without reward, he finally returned to the little monastery, having decided that if he could not attain to consciousness, life was useless and he would destroy himself. Just inside the monastery grounds was a tall tower, and climbing to the top, the monk cast himself off with a silent hope that his search would end in the peace of death. While in the act of falling, consciousness came to him, and with it the realization that the earth below was so surely a part of himself that it would not injure him when he fell upon it. The result of this realization was that he landed on his feet uninjured after a fall which would have killed the ordinary man. His face radiant with the inner conviction that had come upon him, he rushed to the abbot of the monastery who had been his friend for many years, and bowing before the aged man exclaimed, "At last I know, Master, at last I know." I seeing the look of divine understanding upon the face of the mendicant, the abbot smilingly asked, "What do you know?"
"I cannot tell you what I know, Master. There are no words, no thoughts that can express it. If you know, you must know as I know. I can make no revelation of it to any man." The abbot looked at him for a moment and then replied, "It is evident, my son, that you know. The fact that you cannot tell it is the proof that you possess it. Nothing of which we may speak can transcend the world of illusion, for words themselves were created to describe unrealities. Therefore the unutterable is the real and the unthinkable is the true, the utterable is the false, and the thinkable is the phantom of a dream. In this renaissance of the metaphysical we hear much of consciousness and understanding and spiritual realization. But one thing is certain and to be depended upon: he who possesses consciousness will make no effort to reveal it, for the very achievement brings with it a realization of the hopelessness of attempting to communicate the wonders of the self to a world that knows nothing of the contemplative life. People talk glibly of cosmic consciousness and unity with absolute being. But their very words belie the fact. A great Buddhist monk was once brought into the presence of the Emperor of China. And the Emperor addressed him thus, "Answer me, O servant of the enlightened, one question." And the saffron-robed sage replied, "Noble sire, what is your question?" The Son of Heaven answered, "I would know the end of things, the ultimate state. Illumined mind, the universal savior." 67. 68 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Daruma gazed upon him for a moment with a strange expraise. Zion of mingled sadness and amusement amused that any man should dare to ask in words that which no words can explain. Sad that anyone should know so little as to ask so much. Finally the sage answered, "O emperor, bring me a potted plant." A servant brought one in and the monk, looking at it for a second, said, "This is a rare porcelain, is it not?"
"It is."
"Worth a fortune," replied the emperor. Thereupon the sage dashed the potted plant to the hard floor where it was shattered to bits. Filled with wrath the emperor cried out, "Foolish one! What have you done? I have answered your question concerning the ultimate of things," the sage rejoined. "Words fail. Thoughts fail, but in this way I can give you evidence of that which must be evidenced by the self alone." For a time the emperor was buried in thought, and then shook his head. "I do not understand," he said. "Alas," replied the sage, "alas. Sire, I can do no morale. During the progress of our lectures we have been asked again and again to describe those spiritual processes by which the mystery of the self is to be revealed. If those who asked knew or realized the nature of their question, they would know that it is unanswerable by mortal man, and that he who even attempts to give an answer thrice proves his unfitness to possess the answer. Many are the paths of Dharma by which the law is revealed. And more than this of the law cannot be said. He who would know and comprehend must learn to think and dream and feel in the rhythm of universal concerns, leaving behind him the pettiness of personal affairs. To achieve to the end of Tao, he must exchange the rhythm of the senses for that vast ebb and flow of measureless eternity, for only when man ceases to be man is he not man. When he ceases to be a creature, when he ceases to think or to feel or to know, when he ceases to feel his kinship with the earth or the sky, when he is no longer mortal or immortal, when he is neither one with the grain of dust nor with the gods, when all conditions have passed away, when dimension and time have disappeared, when nothing remains except the all-pervading universal self, unthinkable, unknowable, transcendent, and perfect, when the interval between